We're studying the 11th chapter of Hebrews. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that the individuals mentioned in this chapter, there's a great many of them, are pictured as in the stands cheering for us as we run a race. We run the race in our time, the same race that they ran in their own time. And so if you have a Bible and want to turn to chapter 11 of Hebrews, that would be great. It'll also, I think, be available to you on the screen. One of the best-loved photographs from the Life magazine era shows John Kennedy Jr. as a toddler playing under a desk while the president was at work in the Oval Office. Senators, tycoons, heads of state, and others wait in line for an appointment with the president or are denied entree altogether. But ordinary rules don't apply to a son or a daughter, do they? A child has unique access to the Father. And that concept, that children are in a special relationship to the Father, are welcomed in the presence of the Father, is in many ways at the heart of the biblical story. It is the great message that has been proclaimed through the ages. It's the invitation of our Heavenly Father to His children to draw near to Him. That's a remarkable assertion when you think of it, isn't it? Consider how many petty bureaucrats in the world have barriers erected, denying access to ordinary people. Long queues, red tape, written permissions required, electronic barriers, pomp and haughtiness. Refusing people in kind of their self-proclaimed importance, refusing ordinary souls' entrance into their lives, and yet the Sovereign of the universe welcomes His children, delights in His children, wants us to play under His desk if we choose to do so. Some scholars suggest that the central theme of the book of Hebrews, the entire book, not just the 11th chapter, but the entire book, is captured in a single Greek word. It's the word proserchomai. It's used seven times in Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, and it means to draw near to something or to come to something, as I said, draw near is probably the best way of translating the word. And it's always used in Hebrews of drawing near to God or approaching God or the place of His holiness. The term is used in a number of settings, but always with that in mind, that we may approach God. We are invited to approach God. The central section of this book dwells a lot on the idea of priesthood and argues for the priesthood, the high priesthood of Jesus. And we're going to come back briefly toward the end of this message and look at the role of a high priest and what it means for us to have him escort us into the presence of God, for Jesus to be the one who takes us in his loving care and brings us into the presence of his Father. But beyond the role of priests, even more broadly, the invitation is extended. God wants his children near him. And so the word proserchomai, meaning to draw near, is important in this book. And we're going to look spend most of our time this morning in the sixth verse of chapter 11, and where the use of that word is prominent, and we'll spend some time thinking about what we're taught there. Let me just read verse 6 before reading the whole passage for the morning, which is Hebrews 11, 4 to 7. But let me start with just some comments on verse 6, and we will return to this as well. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God, that's proserchomai, who approaches God, draws near to God, comes to God, must believe that He is and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Just to make a couple of observations about this verse. God expects to be pleased with our lives. He pays attention to us. What we think and what we do and who we are is important to Him. That more often than it does, should be an overwhelming thought to us. Why should God care? Given all that might draw His attention, why should He care about us? Why should He want to be pleased with us? Why should He long to reward us, as the verse says at the end? why are we so special? And yet we are. God hopes to be, intends to be, invites His pleasure in our lives because we are important to Him. And further, we have as the central gift that He gives us is Himself, the one who draws near or comes to God. There's simple requirements of faith, but the idea is that the best reward He can give us, the best gift He can give us, is the opportunity to be where He is, to draw near to Him. And again, it's hard to say a more remarkable thing, and yet it is true and proclaimed everywhere in the Scriptures and everywhere in the history of the people of faith. Well, I want to tell three stories. There are three stories, three individuals that are highlighted in the beginning of this long list of individuals in chapter 11. So I'm going to read all of 4 through 7. We'll meet three people. We'll see their examples of God's their having drawn near to God, of their having been receiving life from God, their faith, and so on. We'll learn from that, and then we'll come back and just think about some of the implications of what we're taught in verse 6 again. The fourth verse of Hebrews 11. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up, for he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For the one who comes to God must believe that He is and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world. Eugene Peterson translates that phrase, condemn the world, is that he drew a line, that he distinguished between his own choices and the choices of the wicked world he lived in that sense, condemned by declaring things to be as they were. And he became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So there's three stories here of lives in which God was central, those who drew near to God and received life from Him. The story of Abel, the story of Enoch, and the story of Noah. And they occupy a significant time in history, in the history of the human race. And I think it's worth noting that and then thinking about each of these stories individually. The time that they occupy, the historic time they occupy, is the era before the giving of the law or the speaking of a covenant. Prior to written laws or spoken covenants, all of these individuals existed. They lived their lives. And in that sense, they're somewhat, I think, analogous to or similar to contemporary people, the modern world, the contemporary world of kind of Western world that we live in. Because the laws had not been given, because the specific plan of God had not been articulated, because no covenants had been named, these people interacted with God based on their conscience. And that's what Paul argues in Romans, that those who don't have the law will always have a conscience and will always have a concern for right and wrong that they develop themselves, if nothing else, and they will always feel the need for help in living a life as it ought to be lived. But as was true for Abel and Enoch and Noah, we live in a time when a great many people do not know anything about revelation, about what God has said, about kind of the world of insight that people used to grow up with in this culture just by being part of the culture. Beginning next week in verse 8 and the following week, faith choices will be seen as being made in response to God's declared purpose, anticipating promised rewards by those who know themselves to be the people of God. Abraham, Sarah, and so on. These all had a word from God, a specific word to which they responded. But Abel, Enoch, and Noah, lived in a time before God had said such things. And we live in a time when we have forgotten what God has said in large degree. Many of our contemporaries, especially those perhaps younger than 40 or so, are disinclined to believe that history is knowable, that truth is unchanging, or that God has spoken except in vague terms that differ from person to person. I remember in early adolescence, I was given a lecture by my parents, sort of a discussion, and I think it was my father, but I can't remember absolutely for sure. It might have been both of them. And one of the points they made is that I should be a gentleman. And they were not church people. They didn't quote the Bible. They had, you know, awareness, that kind of general awareness of what was in there. But they had a real clear sense of what a person like me growing up in a family like theirs should be like. And they were pretty clear that there was a God out there. They didn't know much about him, couldn't tell me too much, but I would someday be held accountable for the decisions I made, that the universe had a moral order to it, that I needed to make choices based on the moral order, and they used something like the phrase, be a gentleman, meaning be humble rather than arrogant. Courage is better than cowardice. You shouldn't be overwhelmed with greed or lust for power or out of control sexual behavior. Sex has boundaries around it that are worth preserving in a marriage and the having of children and so on. They had all of these strong sense of right and wrong they passed on to me, not because they knew where it came from, but because they had grown up with all of this as part of their worldview, made sense to them and so on. But we think of what's happening among kind of children, adolescents being raised today, it's a very different world, isn't it? Take the phrase, this is one of the ones that I was told, cheaters never prosper. You can't say that with a straight face anymore. I mean, you'd be laughed out of the room. Cheaters always prosper in the world we live in, don't they? The idea that people shouldn't be greedy, that we should have some governor on how much we let greed govern our affairs. Well, there are strong opinions to exactly the contrary, that greed is good and should all that flame ought always be fanned. That humility is honorable. Why should humility be honorable when you have the chance to be arrogant? And on and on. There's kind of a loss of any sense that we can say what's good or bad or right or wrong or truthful or untruthful and so on. And in a sense, people who grew up in the world of this kind are very much like these very ancient folks who had consciences, who wanted to do right, who kind of hoped for the best but didn't know how to get there, who were kind of wandering and lost but didn't know where to turn and hoped for God and so on. And so we're going to meet and look briefly at Abel, Enoch, and Noah, who also lived in a chaotic world and found nearness to God. My hope, before we're done, is that each of us will think of people we know well, that live in a chaotic world, a world that doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of ethics and morals and direction, but want to know what they don't know. That each of us will be able to pick one or two people in our lives and begin a concern to pray for them, that they will find nearness to God as these three souls did. So let's look at our threesome a bit. Cain, Enoch, and Noah. The story of Abel and Cain, the two brothers who were sons of Adam and Eve, is one of the most mysterious stories. It's very short. You read it in the find it in Genesis and read what is there. There's not very much information. It's been the subject to a great deal of kind of reflection over time. People have wondered about the point. Great literature has been written, many kind of reflections on the story and the struggle of Cain and Abel and how that is about the human condition and so on have been frequently the source for art and literature and other things, whether religious or not. It's one of the archetypical stories. It's a great story. It resonates in every culture. It resonates in every place. And why? Why does this story have that quality to it? This simple story without a lot of detail. Because the elements in it are sort of the ones that we're stuck with because we're human, if you will. Everybody, not everybody, but frequently children are asked when they're growing up at an age when they can talk about themselves, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the point is, we should all want to be something. We all desire to make a mark of some kind on the world. We hope to accomplish something. And each of these two brothers chose a source of accomplishment. One was a farmer, the other raised livestock. They were doing their best. They were taking the world as they found it. They were trying to make a difference in their world. The tension between the brothers, the competition between brothers, the fact that families are often sources of painful experience for people, all of these tell a truth about the real world, don't they? Siblings competing with one another, hurting one another, hopefully not very often murdering one another, but at least hurting one another. Parents unable to pass on life to their children exactly, so that what's best is chosen by all of their children. All of the problems of struggling families, of wanting to accomplish something in the world, the mystery of what's important and what isn't important, jealousy, all of those things are common human experiences, and they're in the story of Cain and Abel, and what Abel, apart from his brother, and it doesn't, again, we're not told a lot in Genesis, why God listened to one and not the other. But Abel pleased God by his faith. Abel drew near to God. Abel's world had God's approval, and he speaks still, even though he has been dead for an extraordinary long time. I sometimes do funerals, memorial services, in which the characteristic of the time is tension in families, where unresolved problems, where anger, where distance, where jealousy, where fighting over assets, and all of that is kind of the dominant theme. And you realize the ability of families to hurt one another is greater than almost anyone else. The kind of hurt you can be to your family members is... We are more capable of hurting them than almost anyone else. So the story of Abel raises the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to accomplish in life? How will you accomplish what you accomplish in a family alongside a sibling who is perhaps competing with you? How will you be who you ought to be, and choose what you ought to choose? And Abel connected with God, drew near to God, received God's blessing in that struggle. We live in a world where people are trying to make those decisions and need God's help to make them. Enoch's story is somewhat different, although it is also an archetype, I think. It is also a story that resonates throughout time in various places. Enoch's story is the story of a journey. It is very short. You try and read the story of Enoch in Genesis, and it's over in two verses. I mean, what in the world? What happened? I don't know what happened. We're told very little about him. But we are told this. He had a son. And when he had a son, he began a journey with God. And for 300 years, he walked with God. And then God took him home. He didn't face death. He didn't even cross that boundary. He just went on this journey with God from this world into the next one. Now, the metaphor of a journey is a common one, isn't it? We want to discover what we don't yet know. We want to go places we haven't been yet. The human heart is interested in crossing boundaries and discovering new things and kind of living a life of adventure and new opportunity. And I think Enoch's story represents all of that. And yet he walked with God rather than by himself. He had a companion that made sense of life to him, and his life became so beautiful and so full and so centered on God that he eventually found himself in God's eternal presence from this life to the next. My son Jeff has a young man that he grew up with and played sports with, and obviously they're therefore the same age. And I saw this young man's father not too long ago. I don't very often see them and haven't kept up with anybody in the family, but I happened to run into the father. So we're saying, "Hey, how's your son? What, you know, these two had played sports together," and we were remembering probably more glory than actually existed, and you know, we were taking credit for it even though they were doing it. And anyway, that conversation had that tone for a while, but eventually I said, "You know, how's your son?" He said, "Well, he went off to the East Coast to an elite school, and you know, he was a great athlete, he did all this stuff, but he dropped out after a year." And I said, "What has he been doing since?" And well, he's been traveling. And he's dropped in and he started and stopped out of three different colleges in the interim. He has lived in different cities, tried different jobs, had relationships that didn't last. And so I finally asked him again, I said, "Well, where is he now?" "Well, he's in Thailand." "What's he doing?" "I don't know." "He's traveling around Thailand on this journey to find something that he hasn't found yet. That the answers he's got haven't satisfied him. And so there's got to be some new place, new thing, new discovery, new something." And I realized in kind of studying this Enoch story that that's what's happening to this young man. Only he doesn't have a companion. He hasn't found that God will partner with him, will walk beside him, that he can be a child of the Father and take on life with that, with the Lord's insight and wisdom and direction and approval. And I realize, I hope he does. That the wandering will lead him to the discovery of the love of God. Noah's story is the longest of the three in these verses. Again, you go back to Genesis and read the story of Noah. We have a great deal of information. Noah's always been a fascinating guy. Again, a great deal of literature, art, you know, lengthy reflection, historic observation, and so on. What can this all mean? And Noah's got a little bit different point. Noah's story has a little bit different point to it than the other two. I think the question in the case of Abel is, what will I accomplish in my life? What do I want to be when I grow up? The question in the case of Enoch is one of discovery and journey and going new places and seeing new things and so on. And in Noah's case, the question is one of integrity, moral courage, standing for something that is true, that you will defend with your life, having a core to yourself and a foundation underneath you that allows you to live your life to the fullest, even if everything around you contradicts it. It's a story of strength. It's a story of moral courage. And again, it's therefore a universal story. Everybody ultimately wants to be a person of moral courage, wants to stand for what's worth standing for, be unbowed in the face of pressure, unwilling to sell out what should never be sold. And Noah tells that story as he was ridiculed decade after decade by the people that surrounded him, who wanted nothing to do with God and lived only for personal pleasure. He was someone different. And if we think of the world we live in, isn't that kind of, don't these guys represent what folks really want? To make a mark that's worth making, to take a journey that's worth taking, to stand for something that's worth standing for. And they found God. They found nearness to the living God as the way to live the way they wanted to live. And we are, you know, who live in a post-Christian world, have a lot to say to our contemporaries that God still wants to be known by people like this. He still extends an invitation. He still loves. He still rewards those who seek Him. He still wants to be pleased with lives like ours. He hasn't changed. Let me return, as I said we would, just briefly to verse 6. because I think that we ought to look at the instruction here in even a bit more detail than we have. I want to say a word to those who in this room who are Christians who are having a hard time. Because when I say that the heart of the gospel, at the heart of the gospel is an invitation to be a child of your Father, to be close to approach, to have drawn near to God. When that, we say that that is the heart of the gospel, there are a great many who are Christian and have been a long time who find themselves at a distance from God, who feel as if their lives are broken. If this is true, and I believe it, and it used to be true, and I acknowledge it, and I even tell other people it's true, but I'm not living this way anymore. I am guilty or doubting or frightened or failed in my Christian life, and I don't feel very near to God. What can we say that will help folks like that? That's question number one. And the second is, what can we say to those who are still wandering? To those who have never begun a relationship with God as He is, and how may they do so, and how can we be part of the process of helping them connect with Him? So let's, again, look a little bit at the instruction of verse 6. The one who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. The conditions for faith, the minimum requirements to either reconnect with God or connect with Him for the first time in just these phrases at the end of verse 6 are very minimal, aren't they? It doesn't say anything about performance. It doesn't say that the one who would come into the presence of God, the one who would draw near to Him, must go through a catechism or must clean up his or her act or must memorize great swaths of the Bible. It doesn't say that we have to be rich or accomplished or know the right people. It doesn't say that we have to join any organization in particular. The requirements are very uncomplicated. The one who would draw near to God, either coming back as a believer who's struggled or coming for the first time as one who is going to enter a relationship, become a child of God, must believe simply that God exists as a person who cares, who knows the hearts of people in this world, that He is not a distant potentate or a machine, that He is a living person who cares for us. You need to believe that He exists as He is. And secondly, that He rewards those who seek Him, that He is not at heart one who punishes and denies and hurts people, that His heart is to give Himself away. That's the other condition, that He exists as a person and that He wants to be good to us. Why are those things hard to believe? Well, I think when we've been away from Him as His children who've wandered away, we often feel as if we shouldn't have done the things or thought the things or gone the places we've gone and so on. We feel as if we've accumulated some load of guilt or some failure, or we don't want other people to notice what we're like, and so we spend time further and further apart from Him. But His desire is to reward us, to express His compassion. I want to read just very quickly two other places in which the word proserchemai, or draw near to God, is used. And it's used about Jesus as our priest, as our the one who loves us enough to take us into God's presence. Verse 15 of chapter 4. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, so that we may receive mercy to find grace, find grace to help in time of need. Let us draw near with confidence. We have one, our Lord Jesus, who has been human in every way that we have, who understands our weaknesses, who has been tempted in every way that we have, who has seen what it's like to be hurt, who understands what it's like to be afraid, who knows the feelings of longing to run from God as he felt in the garden when he wanted to do anything but what God wanted him to do. He's experienced all of those things. He understands us, and he takes us by the hand, and we draw near to God with his companionship. For Christians who worry about failure in your life, the focus for us should be the priesthood of Jesus, the love of Christ, the understanding of his understanding of what it's like to be hurting, weak, inadequate people. In verse 24 of chapter 7, Jesus, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently, therefore he's able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. He prays for us. He doesn't fail. His concern for us lasts forever. He intercedes for us. He speaks on our behalf. He takes us by the hand and brings us home into the presence, drawing near, proserchemai, drawing near to God. But what about those who have never experienced nearness to God, who don't know if it's possible, who aren't sure that God's ever spoken very clearly, and if he has, would he speak to someone like them? And if he would they be accepted? And they know for sure they're lost. They know for sure they're trying hard and not succeeding. But how can we be servants of God who help them find him for the first time? It's not very complex, is it? God exists as a person. We are persons made in his image. He listens to us, cares about us. How can we help people believe those things about God? To express a word of thanks for the gift of a beautiful universe to live in. When something good happens, to be able to turn to him in gratitude. How can we help people in our lives recognize that God is present and personal and will listen if we speak? Can we speak for them? Can we invite them along with us at times when we are enjoying his presence? Can we answer their questions? We must believe that he is. And secondly, to help remove the fear that if one were to come near to God, he would hurt me. How many folks have been given that message by the church, by whatever, Christian history, that God more often hurts people than loves them? But he doesn't. He rewards those who seek him. He gives himself away. It is the reward of his presence, a father who loves them, who wants to help make life make sense for them. He doesn't require of us extraordinary effort, great labors, cleaning up our act, advanced degrees in theology, or any of those things. He requires that we believe that he exists and that we assume that he loves us, that we're willing to assume that he loves us. So the challenge, I think, for us is to ask what role we can play in the lives of people near to us to help them see what's true rather than what's not true. There's a last picture I want to ask us to look at very quickly. It's different than the picture of President Kennedy and his son, but it's not completely different. This is Rembrandt's painting of the prodigal son, the story of the prodigal son, the return of the prodigal son, who is back to his father. And this story is perhaps the greatest story ever told, the greatest articulation of human experience and the role of God. There are wonderful scholarly accounts of the prodigal son and what is taking place in the story. It's a very deep, very remarkable story on a lot of levels. There's a guy named Henry Nouwen. Some of you may have read his books. He spent days and hours every day sitting at a museum in St. Petersburg in front of this painting. just trying to make sense of the painting. And it was Rembrandt who had thought long and hard about the story of the prodigal son who painted the painting. And the story, as it comes to us in Scripture, is extraordinary. And Nouwen went on to write a book about what he learned just by staring at Rembrandt's painting and how much it changed his life. It's the story of a son who humiliates his father, who ruins his life. And it's the story of the father who receives the humiliation without complaint and looks down the road every day hoping his son will come home. And humiliates himself further by gathering up his robes as no important man of his time would ever have done, and ran off down the road to find his son when he saw him coming at a distance and fell upon him and kissed him and threw a party for him because he's home again. This is the story of a father who wants so desperately, while his son is away, for his son to come home, and then he can't be lavish enough in what he gives his child when he comes home. The great news of the Bible is that we become children of God, and children are welcome where their father is. And he longs for us to draw near to him. And all that's required is that we thank him with some recognition of who he is, and that we assume that what we'll receive is good and joyful and filled with blessing. So I commend the story of the prodigal son to you. If you want to do a healthy thing for your spiritual life, spend a month reading and rereading Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son. Spend some time studying it. You may want to get some guides that are either scholarly or devotional or both to think through what's actually taking place. And there's a great deal taking place in that story. I think one of the healthiest things we can do to sort of realign our world is to ask Jesus what everything he meant when he told that story. The other thing I want to issue as a challenge for us, or as a possibility for us, is to take a few minutes right now in quiet and to pray. To think of one or two or three people in your life that want to make a mark, want to accomplish something like Abel did, that are in a conflicted world in which there is tension and struggle, and they would love to have God answer their questions and give them direction and speak a word of approval. They are on a journey like Enoch, perhaps, or they hope for a life of moral integrity like Noah, but they don't know how to go there, how to be there. They wish to know God, but don't. So think of that person, or those two, and we're going to spend a few minutes now just in quiet, and I want to ask you to pray for them, but secondly, to ask what role you can play. Is there a way I can help? Is there kindness or a word or a gesture or an embrace? Or is there some way that I can help them find what they long to find? So pray for your friend and pray for yourself in the life of your friend. And we'll conclude with this time of silent prayer.